Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
First question is, what is this?
What, my arm?
Yeah.
It's just...
Is that like the Stuart Lee thing? Show notes.
Stuart Lee did not invent writing on his fucking hands.
No, but he's certainly the most obvious one when that comes to mind, right?
Every single comedian I know writes on their hands.
Really?
Yeah. I think that's just a standard thing that they do. I'm writing a new show. And these are some points that I've consistently forgotten to mention while I'm on stage. Or they're things that I haven't got around to doing, and they're just reminders to, like, if you have a moment, try and talk about 100%.
100%. Go 100%.
Well, no. Well, I've got a thing that I want to talk about 100%, and I haven't really got around to doing it because I don't think there's room thematically in the show that I'm writing, if you want to get into that.
Yeah, 100%. Which one?
100%. Is that deliberate?
Yeah.
Because
you're doing two shows at Edinburgh this year.
Right, yeah. The first show I'm doing is called I Think You Stink, which is a musical. It's like a horror movie based anthology musical. Where I wrote 11 years ago. I took it up to Edinburgh in 2008. And it was just as I was beginning to start doing stand-up. So I'd done Edinburgh. Well, I'll just tell you about the show for now.
because you did Edinburgh like 10 years on the trot, right?
I've done Edinburgh. I've had 2 years off, I think, or maybe it's 3 years off since 1997.
Wow.
And then I've done multiple shows a year sometimes when I've done stand-up, and I've really been getting into that. You know, since my career's taken off in terms of stand-up, I've only done like one a year. But back in like 2008, for instance, when I did the musical, I was also in a double act, and I was comparing a show and I was doing something else. So you'd end up doing like 4 or 5 shows a day. So this musical I did, it's called I Think You Stink. It's based on horror cliches and horror tropes.
Any specific decade or era of horror?
No, it sort of like spans between the 50s and the between 50s and 80s, really.
So you go from kind of Hammer horror into the slasher.
We don't really do any torture porn.
And you don't do the universal sort of monster stuff.
So I guess there's one that's sort of like based on. So basically, what it is it's kind of difficult to explain. I've never been able to explain it. But when I did it 10 years ago, we had like 5 people come a day, and then there was one day when it rained, and we were sold out. And I think we made 50 quid over the. I think we only did it for a fortnight, but we made 50 quid over the fortnight, like profit, and that was like unheard of. I was just like, oh wow,
that's a win.
We bought a bottle of whiskey and shared it around. So it's not like a traditional musical in that sense, but it's kind of like little vignettes that culminates in like a 15-minute rock opera. So there's like a werewolf one, which is sort of like about binge drinking culture.
Okay.
I mean, it sounds wanky.
Yeah, it sounds. I love monster movies and horror films, well, and I love Rocky Horror Picture Show. And
it's that sort of thing, right? But also sort of like, I think maybe not the best horror films, but it's definitely a part of the genre, especially with horror and science fiction, is that when you have kind of like social commentary in it as well.
With the classic B-movie tropes where you'd have, you know, an alien invasion, but it's actually a metaphor for the Cold War, yeah.
Yeah, and also like consumerism in Dawn of the Dead. So I've got like this song called Beast Boy, which is about a werewolf, but it's actually about binge drinking. And it's like getting absolutely hammered and then waking up in the morning and not realizing
that full moon
being surrounded in carnage and not realizing what you've done, you know. And then there's another one. There's like some straight like spooky things. I think it's like I'm quite proud of the show because there are jokes in it. It's a really funny show, but there don't seem to be kind of like obvious kind of like there are a few setups and punchlines. But really, like, the tone of it is so ridiculous and silly.
It's just good fun.
It's sort of like tongue-in-cheek, but it's not like there's not like loads of obvious jokes in it. It's kind of like more of like a vibe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's the show that I'm most proud of. That's the one show that all of my friends in stand-up have consistently said, well, of course, the best thing you ever did was this show that no one came to see.
That's 12 years old or
and
whatever.
And it's always really annoyed me.
When you put it to bed, did you leave it and not do any work on it until recently? Or is it something that you've kept on adding to and tweaking and going back to over the last decade?
The one thing, I wrote the music with my school friend George Mitten. And we didn't have a lot of time when we did it. And so now I work with a music producer, Andy Jones, and we did all the songs from Uncle on it. We did all the songs from Uncle together. And I think we met in 2012. I think he did. The first thing we worked on was maybe my Edinburgh show, This Means War, in 2012. And then after that, we worked on like Uncle and Heavy Entertainment, and I've done two albums with him, and we're working on a third album at the moment. And
is that out this year?
I think realistically, because I'm doing Edinburgh on a tour, and I'm scraping together two. I'm getting together. it's weird because I've got about two or three albums worth of stuff ready to record, but it's case of what's appropriate for the show. So my other show is called Phoenix from the Flames.
Yep.
And that's about kind of like I haven't done Edinburgh in 6 years, I haven't done stand-up comedy in a year and a half. There's been all sorts of like I've had all sorts of mental health issues over the last couple of years. So it's kind of like this sort of like epic show about returning from a breakup and returning from a breakdown and returning from being away and doing something, you know, doing acting and then coming back to stand-up. So it's about like, all these parallel things. And so you've got to be quite specific about what songs you use. And so my initial thing was that I will use songs that pre-exist that I've already written for my album. And then it's just become more apparent that I've got to write some more specific songs for the show. So that, you know. So what I've always did was I always like used to write Edinburgh shows with like a theme. So I even said it in one of my songs. I like to write shows with a bit of a theme in. Never stop, never stop, never stop dreaming. I did a show called Dare to Dream, and that was all about dreams. So everything about that was about there were poems in it, and it was all about aspirations and nightmares, but they were all around like a spider diagram of dreams, and then what are the offshoots from that. So this is all about kind of like rebirth, and well, it should be when it's finished. It should be about like rebirth and coming back. And
do you feel back already, or are you hoping to feel back through the process of doing these shows? Little column A, little column B?
It's a bit of both, because I'm not ready yet. But I think that you get ready in the time that you're given. I think if you're given 7 years, it'll take 7 years. But if you're given 3 weeks, then you'll have to do something in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And it will be what it is. I learned that in most things that you do, you end up kind of like having very tight deadlines. So we did, I've done two short films with the BBC. They were both on iPlayer. And I think the first one was Valentine's.
Didn't one of them get a BAFTA nomination?
That was that one. Elephant, yeah, that I wrote with Esther Smith, who was in Uncle with me. We met on Uncle, and I had this idea from... I lived in Brighton in 2005, and I had a best friend who was a girl, and we just hung out all the time, but we never had any money. So we were so skint. So we'd be like making, we'd be making rollies out of the ashtrays.
You know? Yeah. Butt rollies. Yeah, I've been there. The end of the night, like, oh God.
In the middle of the day. and we'd go to art exhibitions so that we could drink the free wine and stuff
like that.
You know? And so that
you
was
find
like,
the loopholes.
That was the basis for the short, and then I pitched it as a TV series, and they didn't have room for a TV series at the time, so they had like this then they said we've got this short season coming up for Valentine's Day. I was like, oh great. And then I was like, if it's going to be online and no one's going to watch it anyway, can I direct it? And they were like, yeah, sure.
So was that your first time behind the camera?
That's my first time. I did theatre when I first started doing Edinburgh, but then that's my first. And also you're kind of directing yourself when you're...
A stand-up, of course. Yeah.
But I think by that point I'd done heavy entertainment. So you're very sort of like hands-on. If you're doing stand-up... The thing that makes you unique as a stand-up comedy is basically all your instincts. So, you know, you decide what you say, you decide how you say it and what you do. And as soon as you start working in TV, everyone else suddenly has an opinion about what it is. And some people's opinions are bang on, and they know exactly how to package you. And some people... it's a job for them, and they don't necessarily give a specific shit about...
They want the quickest and easiest results.
They're just like, we've done this before, we know how to package new comedy or new acts, and so we'll do a bam, bam, bang, and now you're on TV. So when we did Heavy Entertainment, I was very protective of what I did, because I'd done other shows where I'd been done live stuff, and I felt like... it didn't best represent me. And in actual fact, when they asked me to do Heavy Entertainment, I mean, they asked me. I'd already done a show. Is this a bit dry? Are you interested?
I'm fine, mate. I'm having a great time. Yeah.
So when we did, they asked me to do Heavy Entertainment. I'd just done a show, which is easily Googleable, but I'd just done a show where I'd been done live stuff on it. And I didn't enjoy that process. Whenever we filmed it, we were on at the end of the night, which was the point where the audience got up and left.
And are they all drunk by that point? Or?
No, they're not drunk because it's a TV record. But,
right, so there's no alcohol on set.
There is. I'm sure there would have been drinks, but it's not like there's an open bar.
When we're filming,
they're sat down. So we're filming at BBC. But it's like everyone, it's like, oh, right, trains.
They're getting restless. Yeah.
It's also, we did like two episodes a night. So it's like they get there at 7 or 6. They probably get there about 6. We start recording about 7. And then it just goes on until about, I think we were probably on about 10:45. So they've been sat there for quite a while.
Yeah.
And also TV... Audiences on TV shows tend to be like living props.
Yeah, yeah.
Where
yeah.
they're there for the audience at home's benefit to make it feel live. So they're not that they're not treated brilliantly, but like I don't know how they're treated. I don't do it. But so we were on at the end of the night, and then it'd be like it was a band. I did my band. So it was me with my band. And
what's your band called?
The Helmets.
The Helmets.
And
two T's, ES.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they'd go, all right, music. So everyone would get up and leave. So we did all of these episodes of this show, and you could see my dreams dying in my eyes. And I was like, so they said, do you want to do a live show? Do you want to do this thing? And I was like, no, I don't. And they were like, oh, well, we've got money. So we've got to spend this money by the end of the tax year. So do you want to do a pilot at least? And I was just like, well, I'll do a pilot. I'd done a live radio show at Christmas. And then I said, oh, I'll do this pilot. So we called it Heavy Entertainment with this pilot. And then, and that was sort of like a bit of a nightmare where I wasn't an exact fit with the guy that produced it. And then they said, do you want to do a series? And I'd got a lot of, it was my first bit of TV, and it was like that I'd sort of authored.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And because it was so personal. I said, do you want to do a series? I said, yeah, but not like that. I don't see, because it had sort of like an arc where there was a beginning, a middle, and an end. I had a breakdown. I was just like, you can't do that arc every week. So we'd have to rethink about how we did a series. And also, I just felt like it was so shiny, floor light entertainment the way we'd done it, which I guess could have been part of the joke. But my instincts were always kind of like, I like...
I guess the equivalent of like a band going on Top of the Pops, right? It feels like that same sterile, clinical.
Yeah, and we were in a huge studio
environment.
We were in a huge studio as well, and we didn't quite have the budget to fill it with stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So it looked quite spacious, that pilot did, and it was kind of like the exact sort of thing that I didn't really want to make. But we had a month to do it. So this is the thing about time limits. This is how we started talking about this. Is time limits. So I think I had 3 weeks to do that pilot from beginning to end.
Right.
So I went in. I think some people's dreams as a comedian is to get their live stuff on TV, and I genuinely hadn't. I'd always wanted to do acting and directing and writing, but I'd never really wanted to do my stand-up act on TV. So we had 3 weeks to kind of like work out what that was. We did it, did the pilot from beginning to end in 3 weeks, and then it was like, oh right, well, not like that. So when we had the series, that we sort of I went back to work out what it was that I liked about TV, stand-up on TV. And that all boiled down to stuff like Jack D's Channel 4 show from the 90s and Harry Hill's show from the 90s. It was basically all 90s stuff. Fist of Fun with Stuart Lee and Richard Herring.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was like it all boiled down to those kind of like, oh, the Mary Whitehouse experience as well, and doing something that was kind of like very kind of like.
Well, no one's really doing that at the moment, are they?
Well, even when we did it for Heavy Entertainment, it was kind of like I wanted to transfer my Edinburgh shows to the screen, and the Edinburgh shows aren't big budget things. The Edinburgh shows are me trying to do a Def Leppard concert in a porta cabin, you know, and it's like, and you
I just saw them do Hysteria at Download in full. It's fucking brilliant.
Was it good?
It was really good.
Oh, yeah. I've seen them a few times. I've met Joe Elliott.
Yeah, yeah. I've had him on the show. He's brilliant.
He kind of like.
All right. He's still a proper, just like loves a beer.
Yeah. Have you seen the Def Leppard movie?
No. Is it as woeful as I'd imagine, but also brilliant?
It's sort of brilliant.
Yeah.
It's it's like this big budget American kind of thing. I think they filmed it in Canada, and
right.
Canada is like doubling for Sheffield. So they've got like, you know, it's like when they're all growing up and you've got like red pillar boxes, but this golden sunshine coming through and there's like a Bobby on a bicycle going down like this, this back lot that's meant to look like, you know, a generic British town, but it's kind of, it's so Americanized, it's really crazy. So when we did Heavy Entertainment, we were just like, well, what are all my favorite stand-up things? And it wasn't kind of like the big glitzy stuff. It was like, and we wanted to have it like looking slightly, not grubby, but low-ceilinged and hot and warm. And
well, then you get the vibe when you're performing as well, don't you?
Absolutely. When you, I mean, some of my best ever performances were done on the Heavy Entertainment Show, and then we had to hack them down to like 20, 28 minutes. But and we didn't really quite have enough time in the edit to work out where it was. You normally get like, you know, a couple of months in the edit or a few months in the edit. But because it was so different from the pilot, we never really got to pilot what the actual series was. So we had like a 5 days per episode to edit 2.5 hours worth of footage down to half an hour. So it was a nightmare.
Scenario. Yeah, I'll bet.
But
are you overseeing that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I was in the edit. But like also, but what we wanted to do is we wanted to do, the way it ended up being executed was different from the way it was filmed. So the way it was filmed was to be, and this is another example of how kind of like people don't quite understand your vision or where you're coming from, because I'd done Edinburgh for many years, and then eventually they said, do you want to do, have a go at putting that on? Shane Allen, who's been absolutely amazing for me, he's always given, he's the one that, you know, let me direct Elephant. And with what I was saying about time restraints was that with Elephant, we had 1st of January, had to be delivered by the end of January. So we had 4 minutes from beginning to end. Me and Esther wrote that in. We had a week planning it, a week to write it, a week to film it,
a week to edit it.
And then it was done. And then it got BAFTA nominated a year later. And it was just like, oh, wow. So that, and then The Killing Machine, which was the thing I just did about, what I did a year ago, actually, about boxing. I had 5 weeks from beginning to end on that, where I didn't even have a concept. And you know, and then I went to the gym and I did some boxing. I was just like, I'm shit at this. Let's make a thing about this. And then we did it. And then I ended up, you know, going, oh, actually, you know, they're very different tonally, but like they're also both sort of like romantic comedies in a way. And but you know, you have a limited amount of time and then you do them and then something amazing can come out of that, especially if you go in without a preconceived idea sometimes. This is a lesson to anyone listening. If you go in without, you know, you go, sometimes you're, it's frustrating sometimes because your pet projects are the ones that are constantly on the back burner.
Yeah.
And then they'll say, have you got anything for Valentine's Day? And you'll go, although that one was a pet project, but yeah, have you got anything for Easter?
Yeah.
And you'll go, I've just been to the gym. And then you'll do it. And then you'll go, oh, yeah. And it's a time capsule. You know, it's whatever you did within that month at that time of your life on that year. And it sort of encapsulates that. But with Heavy Entertainment, when you're talking about like when one is talking about visions not aligning, there was an executive on it that was saying, oh, God, do we have to have that shot? You can see how much he's sweating. Why isn't somebody wiping the sweat off him? And you go, the sweat is the show.
Yeah.
You know, the sweat, I mean, no one sweats on TV like that. You know what I mean? It's just kind of like that was the point. And also in trying to capture like that Edinburgh atmosphere and what a live experience was. So the way the show was conceived was that you would film for 2 hours. You'd film like a live event and then you would do sort of like an edited highlights where it wasn't necessarily like you're truncating two, you're massaging 2 hours. Like what they would do with 8 out of 10 Cats is they would record. I mean, that's a long record. Sometimes that's like a two and a half hour record. The audiences get very tired of that. And then they edit it down to half an hour. And with our one, it was meant to feel like an evening that was kind of like, that very much like Elephant was made, where you spend an afternoon with this couple and then it jump cuts its way. So it feels like you've spent an afternoon with them. It's not meant to be 10 minutes in the life of.
But I think when you make TV,
the idea is that
real
this
time.
This was real time. This was a half hour. So then we got bogged down in the edit. We didn't have enough time to explore that avenue. So in the edit, you get bogged down with, which hand was my microphone in? All right, well, we can cheat it with
continuity,
that shot.
Yeah.
Continuity. And the whole idea was that it was meant to be no continuity. It was meant to be just like, that bit, that's a good joke. Now we're going to jump to the next joke and to the next joke. And interestingly, there was that AC/DC live show.
The River Plate.
Is that one with all the split screen?
I think so, yeah.
wasn't it in South America?
Yeah. Live at the River Plate. Yeah.
I think that's one of the most incredible live.
Oh, it's amazing. They're the best live band in the world for me. I adore them.
I mean, we were lucky. I was lucky enough to see them. It was the greatest day of my life. I had some uni friends and some new friends and some comedy friends. And it was about eight or nine of us. And we all went to see them. And we got stuck in traffic. And it was just such a beautiful day. It was when they played at Wembley last. And then we literally... There was like a spot that was big enough for all of us on the
ground,
and we got there, and they came out on stage. And
Fuck, it
was just incredible. But on that River Plate video, it's basically they use split screen, and it feels like it's encapsulating a live experience because you're seeing the band, and you're seeing close-ups of Angus Young on the guitar, and then you're seeing the audience. And the audience was so big when they...
It was like 500,000 people, I think.
When they jump, it's like watching the ocean.
And they were going for it, weren't they?
It was incredible. But there's ripples, like waves in the ocean. And it's just absolutely magnificent. So when we did Heavy Entertainment, that was... I mean, I'm talking a lot about Heavy Entertainment, which is a show that hardly anyone watched, right?
But well, hopefully now they will.
But when we did Heavy Entertainment, we used... Instead of split screen, we got loads of TVs that we stuck around the audience.
Yeah.
Like old sort of like fucked up TVs with kind of like static on them and stuff.
At an angle. Yeah.
And so there's a shot of me on stage, and in the foreground, there'll be a shot of like a close up of the side of my face. So you've got multiple angles within the same shot. So it's kind of like we thought about it like that. Like, what haven't we seen as kind of like live thing before? And that was kind of like about how do we get onto that? We're talking about time limits.
We're here and then Edinburgh. Told you we're going in depth and all over.
So with Edinburgh, yeah, I think that in a way, if I had to do it next week, it would happen next week. Or if I had to do it in a year's time, you'd just put off writing it for a year. What's good about August is that you can't move it.
Yeah,
and that's what I always liked about it. I'd always book myself in. And like at the beginning of the year, January, February, and then there'd always be a show. And sometimes, you know, your life would get in the way and the show would be, you know, when I was doing theatre, the show is basically it's like an exam. It's like summer exams at school. You know, it's kind of like...
The culmination of that 6 months leading up to it,
yeah,
right?
You do all of your revision and then pens down, and then you've got to do the exams, which is Edinburgh. Or... You know, it is what it is when it's in. You can change stuff in Edinburgh, but basically, that is kind of like your final presentation, and then you start again in. You know, there's a new school year. There's a new in September. There's a whole new load of comedians that have been discovered for the first time that August, and then they start, and they're the new guys.
Well, it can happen, can't it, in a year? I mean, was there a turning year for you?
2010.
And was that because of the material you were doing, because the right people were coming to see you? What was the elements at play, do you think, that...
I think it was right place, right time. It was like there was an inkling of it in 2009 where I did my first... I spent 10 years writing a play. Or maybe it was 7 years. Yeah, so in 1998 or 1999, when I was still at school, I started writing a play. I had the idea, the nugget of an idea for a play. And in 2006, I put myself in for Edinburgh, and I was just like, if I don't do it this year, I'll never do it. So I wrote this play, and it's the culmination of 7 years' worth of work.
One-man play?
It was a two-man play.
Two-man.
And it was like a duologue, or two parallel monologues. And we worked really hard on it, really pleased with it. Did it in St. Albans, got loads of good feedback. Took it up to Edinburgh. Got one star in the Scotsman.
One star, fuck.
And we were like, oh no. And apparently they phoned up the theatre, but I still, I'm not 100% convinced. But they said it was a printing error and it was meant to be two stars, which I think is worse.
Yeah,
because at least if it's one star... You get people coming to see you out of morbid curiosity. But if it's two stars, then it's just like you can't sell
just,
that
just
at all.
Just forgettable, yeah.
So we packed out the next day after our one-star review came out. And we actually won the audience over. they at first they were like laughing ironically at everything that we were doing. It's like that bit's not even meant to be funny. and then by the end of it, they sort of like, what, we won them over. But I was just like, if you're going to spend 7 years writing something, then and get one star, then.
Where do you go from there mentally in terms of your morale and your confidence?
I just thought it was just like, I think confidence-wise, I was sort of like happy with the show, which I think is a big important thing that you can justify to yourself. If you're not happy with something and someone says, that's shit, you know,
then
you're
crushed.
And you agree with them. You're just like, yeah, I know, you're right. I should have, you've let yourself down. You feel like you should have tried harder. But if you don't agree and you can justify that, then I don't think it really matters what anyone says. And so I think that there's, and I think that from a creative point of view, everyone at some point will sit on either side of the fence. They'll go, no, you're right. I did that. It did lack in places. Or there'll be some projects where you can absolutely defend it to the end, you know? But with the play, I was just kind of like, oh no, I was still happy with it. I found it quite baffling. And then it turned out that it was written by, the review is by a journalist that had seen us before, and she hadn't liked anything that I'd ever done. So it was kind of like, oh, fair enough. But also it's good because it gives you the attitude that,
well, fuck it.
Yeah. And also, you learn, well, I've learned over the years, I'm not particularly interested in reviews. I'm not interested in what people say. I mean, I'm lucky up to this point. That's metal, isn't it?
That is metal. It's not quite metal. The same. It's going to have to work.
But I'm lucky that I've generally had nice reviews. But I still steer clear of reading them.
And do you apply that avoidance to the online commentary as well?
Oh, fucking worst, right? Online is just ridiculous. Also, people just think that they're right online.
Yeah.
And you know, I'd be one of them if I did it, but the thing is, there's no room for debate.
No,
you know, I did a live at the Apollo, and someone got in contact with me. You know, someone just, you know, tweeted me at live, left my live at the Apollo thing, saying, something like, nice one, mate, making fun of people with taking the piss out of depression and suicide and stuff. And you go,
no, I'm not taking the piss out of people with it.
I suffer from depression, and I'm talking about my experience with depression, and I am within my rights to talk about and to make jokes about anything that I directly come in contact with. There's a difference between making fun of. And even if, and to be fair, I would be allowed to make fun of it. I would be allowed to make fun of my own condition. But there's a difference between making fun of other people with it and talking about your own experience with it in a humorous way. And so, you know, somebody, this is as an example. So somebody has an opinion on you based on that. And then you kind of like meet them and not meet them physically, but you know, you take what they say on board, and then you argue your point. But then, your point doesn't matter because they've made their decision. Another thing was somebody called me anti-Semitic once. Right? They said your song is anti-Semitic, and the point that they were
what was the line in there?
The song was from
that got their goat.
The song was from my song. The line was from the song Wings, which is where I say, I've got no love for the Dewey Decimal System. And they thought I said Dewey Decimal System. And they called me anti-Semitic. And you go, the Dewey Decimal System is a system named after a guy called Dewey. Was it, his name wasn't Dewey Decimal, was it? But it was like Dewey something. And you go,
With
the D, and it was just kind of like it's the library referencing system that they use in the libraries, you know. You go, so it's kind of like anything can be taken out of context,
if people are as stupid as they often.
I mean, that is fucking ridiculous. You just like, oh my God. But then in the world, there's at least one person out there that thinks that I'm an anti-Semite.
Well, probably two or more, because he'll have told at least one friend.
Oh my God, I'm not listening to that guy again. And you'd hope. I mean, it says more of a statement about libraries and the fact that they're dying out than anything else.
It's, right, it's just an antiquated reference.
The Jewish decimal system is kind of is dying out. But so I did this play, and then in August, and then in September I did my first ever gig, September 2006, and then I did my second gig in like January 2007.
Have you always been quite a confessional stand-up comic?
No, it was much more of an act. Well, no, let me see. I think that my act has evolved in the sense that I'm a lot more comfortable as myself on stage now.
So you can be more open and so I can be more vulnerable.
I wouldn't say that. I would say is that because I'm thinking a lot about it, because this is my first Edinburgh show in 6 years. I did a tour show 2 years ago, which was very sort of confessional and anecdotal, and I told a lot of stories about my life and stuff, So not celebrity stories about my life, but sort of like, you know, just it was a storytelling show where you're kind of like
about your experiences,
or about like one, you're threading kind of like this story together, so at the end of it it's kind of like ta-da. So that was new for me, but what I would say is that all of my plays, and I used to write music, and I still write music, but I started off in a couple of bands at school, wrote music, wrote poems, that went into theatre. I started writing theatre because I was terrible at auditions, so I was really rubbish. I wanted to act, rubbish at auditions, so I never got any parts. So then started writing.
Proper Renaissance man, Nick.
Well, out of necessity, but also, you know, Renaissance man, definitely. But all of this stuff was shit when I started.
Yeah, and but everybody stuff, starts shit.
You do
unless
stuff
you're one
for
of
20
those.
Years and you eventually get good, or you get a break, but it's consistency. You know, it's kind of like there's talent, there's luck, there's hard work, there's, I don't know, perseverance. And I think that you need a bit of everything.
Yep.
You can work really hard, but in the wrong direction, and not realize that. And no one's saying that you didn't work hard, but you worked hard on the wrong thing,
mm-hmm.
or you were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Unlucky. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, you had that moment, and they didn't, and it was the best thing you ever did, but nobody saw it. You know. So this is kind of like, so then your way of getting around the right place at the right time is just to keep going. Because eventually you will get a break. I was doing stuff, you know, I wrote my first show in 2000, my first Edinburgh show in 2001. I only got an audience in 2010. So that was nice.
So that's the perseverance element. If you didn't have that, you would have jacked it
you
in
just keep
long
going.
Before.
But then, but that's luck as well, because by the time I got to 2010, and I'd already given up on my dreams. So when anything good happened, I really appreciated it. I loved it.
And if you didn't have expectations.
Didn't have any expectations.
Disappointment didn't come.
So it was kind of like, if it had come to me in 2001, I wouldn't have known that it's meant to be hard. And, it, you know, and so I just think that gave me a lot of perspective. Also in that amount of time, I wrote. So by the time anyone found me, they said, have you got anything else? And you go, yeah, I've got almost 10 years worth of material. Yeah.
Brilliant.
So that, you know, they go, can you do a TV show? And you go, yeah, because I've got this, and this, and I've got like all of these notes and these ideas that I've been writing. And
songs as well.
Songs, you've got like a whole backlist of stuff that you can use, and no one's seen it because it's all been kind of like, so that is.
So it's like training really, isn't it? It's like.
Yeah, it's
you're forming.
Apprenticeship.
Yeah, yeah.
You're kind of like doing all that stuff. So also, if you, I mean, the way I think about it is if you get, you know, there's a lot of, when I was, I'm not sure about now, but when I first started out, there were loads of comedy competitions. and you'd have to do 5 minutes, and that's all anyone had when they were new acts anyway. It was 5 minutes, and then the prize would be you get to do 20 minutes, and you go, oh, so I've got 5 minutes and of good stuff and 15 minutes of filler. And so then you'd instantly be found out because you didn't have the, you didn't have enough material.
Yeah.
And I just think that, you know, good things come to those who wait. And I think that, you know, it's about like building up a portfolio and a repertoire and kind of like, and by the time that you get, it's just be about being patient really. Like if you really want it, work hard, and you can learn talent as well. So talent is, you know, you can, through trial and error, you can learn what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, if you're, if you've got no stagecraft, you get up on stage and you can get over your nerves, or you can at least hide your nerves. And these things come with practice. You don't have to be naturally gifted at something. You can kind of like learn how to do that, if that's what you want to do. And then, you know, so it's kind of like there's a lot of, if some, if people are out there are listening and they're trying to kind of like, in whatever, you know, not just stand up, but like in any walk of life, you know, if you work hard and you're persistent and you get out there. I mean, I wrote in, I had like a big, patch of depression in the mid 2000s.
Did it come from out of nowhere? Did you always have?
I think I've always. I think I've always been depressed, but
Does it run in your family or?
No, not so much. I don't think. But it's. I'm sort of like exploring it in my show at the moment, and I'm sort of like talking about it on stage a bit. A lot, and but it doesn't have to be morbid. But you can talk about depression and mental health without making it like sad.
Yeah,
but
well, the same with death.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like these are these subjects. These are things be that taboo.
Should. Yeah, exactly. They should be.
Should you just should normalize them and.
Yeah, and the thing about the way I'm trying to sort of like with. There's a difference between sadness and depression.
Mm-hmm.
And you can be sad without being depressed. But the thing about depression is when even when you're happy, it's still there. It's like a black cloud over you. And you can have kind of like days or weeks where you're sort of happy, but it's kind of like that it follows you around.
Dude, I have it like no one's business. So I get it.
It's
a constant niggling fucking...
and
challenge, isn't it, to overcome? Yeah, that's the way I try and look at it. It's like a
ups and downs, and I think that the important thing to remember is when you're down, there will be an up.
Yeah.
But the flip side of that is when you're up, you know that there's some sort of crash coming, and it's kind of like a very, it's a difficult thing to sort of like, it's famously a difficult thing to deal with. But I went through a big patch of depression. So one of the things that I've found that I've been able to deal with, the way I've been able to deal with depression, is that I've always been creative.
Yeah.
So I've always thought, even when I'm depressed,
I'll express
myself, or I'll write about it, and then at least something positive is coming out of that period of time. There was a big patch in the mid-2000s, actually when I was living in Brighton, and it was the worst time of my life. And I met my friend, and she saved me. There was a big patch where I would not leave the house. I would write and write and write, and I would be so frustrated because I wasn't getting anywhere. But one of the things that I realized afterwards was that you can write the greatest thing in the world. You know, you can write the greatest stories or the greatest songs, but until you show someone else and you get out of the house and you get up out of bed and leave outside the front door, no one will know about it.
It's like the bedroom jammer, you know, you could play any lick in the world, but until you get out and perform that to an audience, what's the point?
It's only part of the puzzle. And actually, one of the things that I genuinely believe is that good things happen when you leave the house.
Absolutely. Do you know Frank Turner? You know that singer?
No.
So he has a real kind of thread through all his music where he's all about getting outdoors and being outside and interacting with people on the street. And just even if you go for a walk, like if you're feeling like shit, don't stay indoors with the curtains closed, which is a typical go-to kind of, I think, solace place of comfort for people who are feeling down, isn't it?
And it is comforting.
It is, yeah.
But yeah, getting out. And it's not just about getting some fresh air, you know, about...
just the people that you might interact, bump into.
Exactly,
and the,
interacting
the connections
with people. And if you're creative and you're frustrated and you're on your own and you're in your house, get out. I'm doing a song. I've been doing a song in my previews that I wrote 14 years ago that I've never played before in front of another human being. One human being, in fact, was my teacher, my ex-teacher at the time, because I'd left school by then.
Yeah, you hadn't broken up.
and then I haven't played it for anyone, and I'm playing it now, and people, it's really sad, and it doesn't really necessarily belong in a comedy show, because it's really sad. But I think if everything else is funny around it, it might work, and if not, I'll cut it. But it's getting like positive responses, and you go, why didn't I play this 14 years ago? I could have had a different life. Do you know what I mean?
Do you think that sometimes it's good to elicit emotions aside from humor in a
100%
a stand-up show as well?
100%.
Like unease, kind of.
Yeah, I did a show in a tiny cabin, and we filled it with dry ice. And it was confusing and scary to everyone entering. We played rock music like so loud that people couldn't think straight. And then I came out with lights in the darkness, with like fairy lights all over me, spelling my name out. And people were fucking terrified of me for an hour. And that wasn't what we necessarily intended. It was meant to be an intense show, but we came out and people were fucking terrified. I did one show where the entire front row ran out of the cabin because it was so overwhelming for them, like in different stages throughout the show. And I love that.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted that show to be like surviving the Saw ride at Thorpe Park. You know, it's
I made it to the end.
Yeah, and that's like a proper rollercoaster. And then some shows meant to be kind of like just, I've written some shows that were just meant to be silly. I've written some shows that were meant to be like bittersweet, and I'm sort of
and
like,
a bit of a cry is good as well, right?
I love that stuff. I love that. I mean, I think that there's always, I mean, if you look at something as mainstream as Pixar movies, they're amazing. That
well, the first like, 5 minutes and up, like something like
first
that.
First 5 minutes of up, the Jessie song in Toy Story 2. I mean, I think Toy Story 2 is a masterpiece, right?
It's so good. Have you seen 4 yet?
I haven't seen it. I didn't love 3.
I didn't love 3 either.
I felt like it was just like, I felt like 1 and 2 were great.
Gold standard.
3 is still very good, but it was all, it was like, I feel like, this one's for money.
Yeah.
And then also I felt like the existential stuff that they were bringing into it was almost pornographic. It was just like, you're just trying to outdo your last show, you know, your last film. So this one I'm kind of like, yeah, okay, I will see it. But Toy Story 2, or when the Pixar films work really well, is that they're really funny and then there's something that's just hits a nerve and is like spot on. Really sums something up, and then it kind of makes all the funny stuff contextualized, you know?
It gives it weight as well, right?
Yeah. And I think that I some of my favorite comedians are just like I love Lee Mack, and his shows are just so funny and you laugh for an hour. There is obviously there's room for that, and as a comedian you don't have to do that, but for my personal taste and what I do, I think I do like mixing those things, and I don't see why everything has to be funny, and I don't see why everything has to be rosy, and I do try and leave my audiences on a high. I do love it when they leave my shows feeling like energized and excited and happy. That's obviously my goal, but I don't always feel like the most direct route there is to go, isn't everything great?
Yeah.
I think that if you
take them on a journey,
if you take them on a journey, and you know, it's not an easy journey, and then you land them safely at the end. You know, we've all been through something together. And if people cry, I mean, I don't know, I haven't got to that point where I'm actually just, I've pieced the entire show together. I don't know. I know that my last tour that I did, I had a story about a wanking story that went horrifically badly, and like men specifically were fainting.
Actually fainting, passing out.
Fainting, they had to, the people had to,
and so that's it, like, was graphic in its nature.
It was so graphic. It was just horrific, right? And true story as well. And they were like, I think it happened at like at least five, maybe six different gigs out of a 30-date tour. And
you've got to be happy with that, right?
That's, I was so happy about that. But that's what that show was attempting to do. That show was meant to be like a horror
visceral
show. It was not meant to be a horror show in terms of vampires and werewolves, but it's a horror show in terms of like, it crept up on people without them expecting it, and then
just
like,
shock and disgust.
Yeah, and it was just that this moment, and people were fainting. And you go, I'm very concerned for the individuals. But that is definitely going on the poster next year. So that's one reaction that you can have. But then I think that getting something other than laughter out of an audience is fun.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
How did TV help the stand-up, or did you take time away from stand-up when you started doing the TV?
It depends what TV.
Like Uncle, when you started Uncle, were you still doing regular stand-up shows and tours around that first season?
Oh, yeah. And in actual fact, I continued to do stand-up to the point when I have gigs, the day is ruined because I get so wound up and tense about the gig that I can't get any work done because I know that I've got this gig coming in the evening. So I'm just sort of like, I spend, you know, all day worrying about that.
So that's obviously not a conducive headspace to be occupying when you're on set.
No. So when I'm also, it's a very long day. I mean, I've just worked with Ramesh Ranganathan, and he's crazy how much he works. I wouldn't consider myself lazy, but he's
machine, is he?
It's ridiculous. And plus he's got a wife and kids.
Yeah, that's the other thing, isn't it? It's when you see these guys who are like omnipresent and always working, but then also have a private life and a family life as well. But how are you balancing it all?
I think there's part of it is a bit like, it's just like any job where you work Monday to Friday every week. The difference with Ramesh is that he'll be working on TV shows. But then once he's finished one TV show, there'll be another TV show afterwards. But it is a case of just working every day.
Yeah.
You know. So I think there is that. And actually, that's the dream. is to just be consistently
working. Well, it's great to be busy, right?
But when you're
keeps
working,
you distracted from your demons as well. That's what I find.
I love it. I love
I'm not
working.
Busy. I'm like, oh, I hate my life.
No, yeah, absolutely. And then, but the difference is about the fact that he's working. I mean, you get up at what, 5:30, 6 o'clock. You go in to set, and you're there about 7:30. You're in makeup, and then you're on set at 9 o'clock. Then you're recording until 7 o'clock in the evening, 6 o'clock in the evening. Then you're home by 7:30, 8 o'clock, and then he'll do like new material, an hour, a tour show, work in progress, charity gig,
podcast that he does,
and it's
everything.
And it's just sort of like you go, okay. But
you should start a podcast, man, with all your music as well. You could do something great.
I do a radio show on FUBAR Radio with my friend Nathaniel, where we just talk about films, and that becomes a podcast. But I do think that there's there are a lot of podcasts, but also I think that there's a lot of comedians that do podcasts, and I don't necessarily know it's a bit like getting a tattoo. What would it be?
Well, I think you could offer something unique to the podcast canon because of the background in theatre, music, comedy. It could be a proper all singing, all dancing variety show.
Sure.
In the old school sense.
Sure. I don't know.
Would you do a live album?
I've got two albums based on recordings from Dare to Dream and Keep Hold of the Gold, which were my first two breakout shows in Edinburgh. So I've done them. So I think, and I've got the Uncle album. So I've got about like five albums, but two studio albums. So yeah, I just do what comes and then.
Do you like being in a studio? Do you like recording?
I've got an idea, then yeah. But if I'm in a studio and I haven't got an idea and I'm trying to write one, then no. I'm kind of like, in terms of creativity, it's, what generally happens is it's 100% inspiration.
You can't just shit it out.
No.
Yeah.
Well, on something. Well, I'll tell you what though. So when we did Uncle, they would say, right, we want a country ballad called No Survivors, and it's equating a relationship to a horrific accident, and that's like, I wrote all the songs for the first series of Uncle in 1 week while I was on holiday in Egypt with food poisoning. So I spent most of the time
just
on the toilet.
On the toilet, notepad in hand.
With an iPad, just singing into my iPad.
No, survived.
And, but that was just, I wrote a song a day while I was away, and then it was kind of like,
I love the music in that show. It's great.
What I love about it is because if you have to generate all your own ideas, then it's overwhelming because you go, oh, literally, I could write something about absolutely anything. So I'll write about nothing. But on Uncle, they would kind of prompt you and then you would change it. Like, for instance, No Survivors wasn't a country ballad in the end. It's like a Bryan Adams, Guns N' Roses, like rock ballad. But you'd make changes and sort of like the titles would change and kind of, but they'd give you the information you needed and they needed, because they didn't want like every single song to be in the same genre. So you'd kind of like write.
What was the hardest one to write?
Oh, the hardest one to write. It's funny though. The hardest one to write was Fight for the Future from the last episode of series two, which I hate that song because I think it's pointless. When the songs work, they do storytelling.
And
so the characters have moved on. It's either character stuff where you learn something about the character.
Yep.
Or it's story stuff where by the end of the song, the show has moved on in terms of plot. And those are the ones where you go, if you took the song out, the show would be less rich in a way. And with Fight for the Future, you could easily remove that song. It doesn't mean anything.
It felt like it was shoehorned in.
It was just like, but it was kind of like, I didn't agree with the brief as well on that. It was kind of like, we want stuff about, the, you know, it's going to be like painting this picture of a futuristic thing. And I'd like, I think I did so many drafts of that, that it actually, that one song hung over me for the entire shoot of that second series, where I was going into the recording studio at the weekend, and if I'd have an afternoon, like I was in virtually every scene, so I never had any time off really, but occasionally you'd have like an afternoon where you weren't needed, so I'd have to go back into the recording studio and just basically bang my head against the wall getting Fight for the Future done. And then you get it and you go, it's absolutely fine, but in terms of what it means
what
for the show, you know, if somebody said this song is like, I wouldn't be able to defend that song particularly, because it was literally, that was one where it was just an absolute grind.
Yeah, yeah.
But then saying that all the songs are really difficult, in the last series, they had enough budget for 4 songs in 7 episodes. And I think we had a budget for, maybe it was 3 songs for 7 episodes in the last series, and it was 4 songs for 6 episodes in the second series. And I wrote 6 songs, but they only used 5 in the first series. And I was just kind of like, well, if you don't want to use the songs, you don't have to put the songs in for me.
Just for the sake of having them in. Yeah.
If you don't want them, don't put them in, you know. Yeah, because I don't want you to feel like...
It wasn't your list of demands, minimum set of songs.
It wasn't my idea. The original series...
It wasn't written by you either, and this, I think, is a common misconception.
And I don't understand where that's come from, because it says at the beginning of every episode, written by Oliver Refson and Lila Van Hoog.
Yeah.
at the beginning of it, I write the songs, and I think that... So originally there was a script going around, and I don't know how long it was
going. Was the part written with you in mind?
No. There's a script going around that was, I was writing some blaps at Channel 4, at Baby Cow, which was Steve Coogan, Steve Coogan's company. So when I was in Edinburgh in 2011, Henry Normal, who's Steve Coogan's partner at the time, a business partner, came to see my show Dare to Dream. Then I got nominated for the Foster's Award. Then... Channel 4 said, do you want to make some blaps? And I said, yeah. And they said, you can work with anyone you want. And I was like, Steve Coogan, because he's my hero. And Channel 4 and Baby Cow didn't really have a working relationship at that point. It was all BBC. I did the blaps with them. And part of the blaps were, I was writing a thing about a guy on a park bench talking to a kid and giving him bad life advice. For Baby Cow, and Henry Normal came in and he said, look, this is your first bit of TV. What I suggest you do is you take 2 songs and a poem that have already worked. You know, you've done them live, you've tried and tested them. You take 2 songs and a poem and we make them into your blaps, right? And I was like, fine. Okay, I was a bit disappointed that I didn't get to write something, but it's like, okay, we'll do that. The blaps are fucking incredible. They still stand up to today. You know, there's 2 really great music videos that I did with my mate John Reish and a poem. And Channel 4 really liked them. And then, coincidentally, Baby Cow got a script for a pilot script called Uncle. And I think it had been around for a year at least. And... it was about an out-of-work actor who had to look after his nephew. And I read it, and I liked the script, but I was also a bit unsure about what direction they were going in. So Henry Normal just said, we've got this script. Can you read it, Nick? And I read it, and I came in. And I was nothing. I just started. I'd literally had 1 year of anyone knowing who, getting any like TV work or anything like that. And... I met Ollie, who'd written the pilot by himself, I think. And we had a little chat. And at the end of the meeting, Henry just said, right, so do you like Nick? And Ollie was like, yeah. And I was like, do you like Ollie? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, well, why don't you have a little chat and then let's get this made? And it was like, what? And it was as simple as that. It was, and I thought that's how TV gets made. Yeah, it's just really easy. And so I just talked to Ollie about the sort of stuff that we're into. I really love the Royal Tenenbaums.
What a movie.
But I also like Happy Gilmore, right? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to know where Uncle was on that.
Tonally, where it was going to sit.
Because I can see it being either on paper. And when we talked about Royal Tenenbaums, I was just like, yeah, good. That's what I want to make. I don't want to make something that's really kind of like crass. And
yeah.
It is that, but it has...
It's got layers and it's got depth, yeah.
It's got light and shade. And the one thing Henry said was, the thing is, if you make him a musician, then Nick can write a song every week. I didn't even come up with that or float that idea. And they made him into a musician. And then because of that, I think that... And then we did the pilot on Channel 4. And I did the pilot instead of doing a second series of this other show where I was doing live stuff. Live at the Electric.
Yeah.
And I really loved...
Did you enjoy the experience of that show? Uncle.
Yeah, the pilot was incredible. I'd never done any...
Proper acting.
I'd done some student films where I was terrible, really big. And so I watched the Michael Caine documentary on acting.
Right. That was your schooling. Love it.
And he just basically says, don't do anything. So I spent the whole time just like talking very quietly and underplaying everything. And then as much as I could. And I got to act with Daisy. And Daisy said, well done. And you go, oh my God, she's an actress. She knows what she's doing. And
it's just such a well-cast show. Like all the characters, even Con O'Neill, is it?
Con O'Neill, yeah.
Fantastic. Like, yeah. Why isn't that guy in more stuff? I've only ever seen him in the Joe Meek film, Chernobyl, and Uncle, but yeah. He's incredible.
Yeah.
Like that scene right at the end of series 3 when he's crying.
Is it Telstar? Is that what it's called?
Yes. Yeah, that's the Joe Meek story.
That's a really great film.
He's so good.
He is great. It was weird because I was in all the castings because we had to have chemistry tests.
Yeah.
So I'd go in. So I had to go for my first chemistry test and we were casting my sister. And I get there and there's this actress stood in the street and it's Daisy. And I recognise her off of Psychoville. And then that was the first moment that I realised that we were doing something proper. I was just like, oh. And then we did a chemistry read, and she was great. And then we did chemistry read with like a bunch of kids, and then a chemistry read with, no, because I did the chemistry read for the series as well when we were picking Melody, and that's where I met Esther. But then we did a chemistry read for the pilot as well. We must have all in the same place. But
it's a wonderfully cast show.
I loved it.
And Dylan Moran.
Yeah, that was a real weird one because it's like Dylan Moran is obviously an absolute legend, and we had some really kind of like great people that came along, and but you couldn't cast too big. Because you couldn't break the little world that
we'd, yeah, he takes it out of the.
But there was sort of like some really good. There were some really good people in it, and also some of my friends were in it.
So, did you know any of the actors previously?
I knew Daniel Lawrence Taylor, who plays
Bruce, right?
Bruce,
yeah.
He was in a sketch group, and I used to put out chairs in a comedy club, and he was in one of the
right.
So he was kind of like. And then we, but I knew him before. And then Gemma Whelan, who has just done Game of Thrones.
Who's,
I think she's.
She's in loads of stuff. She's
great.
She's
a megastar. She's like. She's
she was in that
really
Alice Lowe
well.
Film, Revenge. Really good in that.
She's Gemma's brilliant. But I saw her very first ever stand up gig. And
really?
Because she was an actor and she just started doing stand up to get more stage time for Equity.
Right.
And I think that's why she started, because her agent said, you know, get some more stage. And then I saw her do her first gig, and then, I love her. And Brett Goldstein,
Casper, yeah.
Casper. The thing about that was, I don't take credit for Brett doing it, because he had to audition and work very hard to get the part. But it was written for like a 20-year-old Justin Bieber type.
Right, right.
And I read the script and I was just like, do you know who would be really good, but he's not right, the way you've written it, would be Brett. And then turn up for work and he's at work and you go, oh my God, I love him so much. He's amazing. Like, he's talented in his own right. I didn't get him the part, but so every time that me and Brett had a scene together, I was just, it was always my favorite day, because, you know, it's crazy being on a film set. It's like being on, I always think it's like being on a Cold War submarine. You've got a microphone on all day.
You're having
a personal private meltdown.
We did an interview with Marilyn Manson for Scuzz TV, a channel I used to work on, and he had the mic on and he went off to the toilet and all we just heard was...
Oh, really? Yeah, yeah. It's like you can't do anything private. Nah. Like, and when you've got a friend on set, it's just literally just like, oh, thank God. It's like that Sylvester Stallone story from the 70s. Cradle the balls and crank the shaft.
And how was the experience of Loaded as well? Did you enjoy that one? Like an amazing ensemble cast.
Yeah.
People like Nigel Planner turning up in it.
Because there's us four boys, and then we actually have one of the young ones in it, and you go, wow. Yeah. Loaded was...
That was only one season, right?
It was one season, but it took fucking 5 months to film.
Was it a huge budget? I mean, all the locations you've got, the house itself.
I think it was about $1 million an episode. It was really...
Wow.
Because what it was it was... it was a co-pro between Channel 4 and AMC. Channel 4 couldn't afford to make it unless they went in co-production with AMC, who do like The Walking Dead and I think they did Breaking Bad. So it's like this co-production where Channel 4 put up half the money, AMC put up the other.
Is that why you got the American actress in it?
I think that's why it was, that's why I got Mary McCormack in it, because it was like an international thing. And I went from making Uncle, where we had Elliot on set, who was under 16. So you weren't allowed to swear in front of him, weren't allowed to talk about... it was ridiculous. He was 15 when we filmed the last series, and there was a line that he had to say when he was 15. We were filming in September, and in November he turned 16. And he had a line that was... you're the one that's snorting coke or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he wasn't allowed to say snorting coke.
Doing hard drugs. Is that why that's the line, is it?
So he said, you're the one that's sorting code. And then we waited 6 weeks and then he said snorting coke into a microphone.
And then they dubbed it over.
And then they dubbed it over. And it was just ridiculous.
Wow.
So it went from that to just being us, you know, four guys.
Yeah, yeah.
All the same age, mostly the same interests. I always used to say we were like the Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles.
We all had like, we even got the little layer.
Jim was the leader.
Yeah.
And then we had Johnny was Donatello. I was the party dude, Michelangelo. And you had Sam, who was like Raphael, who'd like go off on his own and play trumpet. So there's kind of like, yeah, and it was great. It was like great in a different way.
Yeah, yeah.
And also it was very hard. It was because with Uncle, I was the star or I was the lead and I hadn't auditioned for it and everyone was cast around me.
Yep.
To make it into a vehicle for me, I suppose.
Which is amazing when you think about
isn't
it?
Which is amazing. I don't mean that in like, but we were doing chemistry tests to make sure that
it fed
we
the
had
story.
The right energy with the other cast members in terms of me.
Yeah.
And with Loaded, they were trying to cast four people. But that was one of those things where I mean, it's the only time I've ever auditioned for something and got the part. And there were loads of auditions for it. And it was one of those things where I think basically everyone in the stand-up or everyone in the comedy industry knew about Loaded.
And probably wanted a piece of it because it was such a fun show to do.
It was a really fun show to do.
Is auditioning horrible?
Auditioning is awful. You even if you have a good audition, you come out of it feeling like a total bell end. You know, there's no way around it.
Yeah.
And also you can have a good audition and you can feel like that was a good audition and you'll never hear from them again. And you can have a terrible audition and then get the part. You know, it's kind of like, you know, that hasn't happened loads, but like with me, but like in terms of, there's no rhyme or reason to it. In terms of, I think they pretty much know what they want when you've walked through the door.
So all you can really do is turn up and be yourself and...
Yeah,
hope
for the best, I guess. But I think that I'd done quite a lot in the previous auditions to make them want me. And then on the final audition, I turned up and I had like this 3-page monologue. And I hadn't learned it because I'm terrible at learning lines. If I get the part...
Which is mad as a comedian.
I can do it really... I can do it quite... With Uncle, I was in every scene and I'd learn them scene by scene, day by day. You know, I'd look at my sides, which is like a condensed script for what you're going to do that day. And I'd look at the lines... And then I'd do the scene, and then I'd forget that scene, and then I'd move on to the next scene, and I'd do that every day for 3 months. But with auditions, the words just don't go in. And with Loaded, I had like this 3-page monologue, and it was like, what would be really great, Nick, is if you learnt it, because when we film you for the Americans, they'll want to see your eyes. And I was like, oh, right, yeah, sure. So there's the casting lady, there was the producer, and there was the director all behind a table with a camera. And then you're sat on a chair in the middle of a room with your script.
And 4 pages of dialogue, you say?
And they say 3 pages of a monologue. And dialogue's not so bad because you get cues.
You're bouncing, yeah.
And then and they said, how long do you think it would take you to learn it? And I was like, oh, I don't know, 20 minutes? And they went, oh, great. Well, do you want to go downstairs in the room downstairs and then come back when you're ready? I was like, yeah, sure. And I left the room and had a full-on fucking meltdown. I was like, you fucking dick. Why the fuck did you say that you could do it in 20 minutes? And then I just have this fucking, it's just awful. I learn in this thing. And I get to the point that it's in my head for like, it's going to be in my head for like 1 minute, 30 seconds. I just need to get in the room, say it out loud in front of the people. And get, you know, on camera. And I went in and I just did it. And then I got the part. But it was just, they're awful. They're always awful. And you always leave feeling like an absolute arsehole. You know, that was a different experience from Uncle. Because it was great because we were all like the same age and had sort of like the same experiences. But it was also kind of, you get very paranoid on a set. And it's kind of... And it's kind of like one of the reasons why I'm going back into, I took a break from stand-up so that I could write loads of TV and write loads of treatments without the threat of having a gig in the evening and all of that. So I took some time off of that. I took some time off for myself. And then going back into stand-up now is kind of like, oh, you get things done faster. Where you get things done.
Yeah, you're not going through all the red tape, are you? It's just right before
you're not. You're not asking permission from people as well to do what you love doing.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, I'd love to make more TV. It's such a slow process. And in actual fact, while you're busy getting TV done, it's invisible work. So people just think you've disappeared.
Yeah.
So when
you go back
and do stand-up, people are like, where have you been? I've literally worked every
writing,
day.
Writing.
So it's nice to go back and do stand-up where, you know, you can write something on stage and just say something and express yourself, like, instantly.
Yeah, right. That day you could write something and then get up and just perform it that night.
When I did my first gig, after this play that took 7 years, after that I wrote something on the bus on my way to my first gig and I said it on stage and I just, like...
The immediacy, that's a rush, right?
I never looked back. It was just like, why would I spend 7 years writing something to find out that it's one star if I can... say something in the moment and get an immediate reaction. Yeah. And that's, yeah. I fell in love with stand-up on that moment. And I wasn't good at it, but I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Takes 100 shows before you even...
I think that you learn something almost, you're always learning. And it was the first time I felt like I was learning since university. That's what my boxing short is really about. It's about finding something that you love doing, not being good at it, but doing it anyway for yourself. And I think, I love stand up. I love everything. It's nice to have a mixture so that you can kind of like keep everything going.
And in yourself, you feeling all right?
I have good days and bad days, you know. Today I'm feeling, I've left the house and I felt, you know, as soon as I saw you outside and you said hello, everything got better.
Oh, that's all right. That's nice.
Do you know what I mean? And it's just kind of like one of those things where you're kind of like, you're in your own space and you think that the world is impossible and you leave the house and then you go, oh, hello. And then
Wayne's World.
You're wearing a Wayne's World hat.
Yeah. They know that. I pretty much wear it every day, so they'll know. Yeah. Dude, we'll wrap it there, I think. Thank you so much for your time.
My hand is very clammy.
Mine is too. Let's clam up. We need to go to a gig together, son, someday.
Yeah, sure.
I'll take you to a show. I'm seeing you got an Alice Cooper t-shirt on.
Yeah.
So you like heavy metal, you like rock and roll?
I like Alice Cooper.
Yeah? You like Kiss?
That's a complicated question, isn't it?
It is.
I like Ace Frehley.
You like Ace Frehley?
Yeah.
Peter Criss?
I love Peter Criss.
Paul Stanley? And Gene Simmons? There you go.
but I like the idea of Kiss.
Well, they're playing soon.
It's the farewell tour, isn't it?
You want to come?
Yeah.
Want to come see Kiss with me?
Yeah.
All right, let's do it.
Okay.
I'm going to hold you to it. I'm going to take you to see Kiss.
I would love that. Yeah.
Done. Whoa!
When we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.